Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Monday, December 16th, 2013. I have a very special guest today, and it's podcast number 362. My name is Ben Stone, but before we get to our guest, let me give an announcement here. I want to really thank everybody for their patience and for their support and for their donations. This is only my second podcast in the month of December, and I produced, I don't know, maybe one or two in November. Once we get into January, we expect, production will increase. There'll be more podcasts. I assume that because my wife and I are going to be in a more stable geographically. Right now, we're still traveling the country in our motorhome. So be patient with me. We'll get back to regular podcasts pretty soon. I also wanted to especially thank whoever it was who bought a lot of precious metals from a Magi Metal through our link there at badquaker.com. Somebody was really smart. Somebody took a large quantity of Bitcoin right around the 1st of December when it was hitting 1200 or so, and they exchanged a bunch of that Bitcoin for some precious metals through our link at Magi Metals. And I think that was pretty smart. I personally didn't let go of any of our Bitcoin, even when it was pegging out over 1200, and we'll get into that maybe a little bit later. But I do want to thank whoever did that, and if I had enough Bitcoin, I probably would have done that at the time, because I think that was a pretty good move. Also, thanks for all the folks that are buying stuff through our Amazon link as well. And speaking of which, let me give a quick book recommendation. There's a book called Abducting Arnold. It's a historical thriller from Becky Akers, and it's about 500 pages, and let me tell you, it is the absolute best historical novel I have ever read. It's a thriller, it's considered a historical thriller, and it is that. It is absolutely that. It will tell, unless you really are a historical geek that has really inspected the life of Benedict Arnold, I can pretty much guarantee that this book will blow your mind. It really has a lot of work put into it, and Becky did a great job writing it. And it's available at Amazon. Just do an Amazon search. Well, go to Bad Quaker first and hit the Amazon link, and then do an Amazon search for Abducting Arnold. And they have it in hard copy or they have it in electronic. Either way, and I really think you'll like it. Now, I do have a disclaimer I've got to throw out. In my last podcast, where I was sort of taking apart Gary North's criticism of Bitcoin, part of that was a somewhat of a defense of Gary North, in the sense that he's attacked pretty heavily by the folks over at Wikipedia, and I specifically referred to the book, The Sinai Strategy, Economics and the Ten Commandments, pages 59 and 60, that's quoted in Wikipedia. And I said that that my copy of that doesn't have anything to do with the stuff that it says in Wikipedia. Now, as this all washes out, the best I can figure out, I bought a copy of that book in 87, and I read it in 87, and then at some point in time, I've given it away or lost it or moved off and left it or something, and then bought a new copy of it. And then I just sat that copy on the shelf. And when a lot of these things about Gary North were brought to my attention, oh, I think about a year or so ago on Facebook, a year and a half ago or something, when someone on Facebook pointed out to me the Wikipedia entry, and I went back and got my copy of The Sinai Strategy, and I found that the Wikipedia entry didn't at all match what it said in my copy of The Sinai Strategy. So based on that, I made my arguments. The problem is, what I didn't know is that evidently there's been there's a modified version of the Sinai strategy, which is what my second copy is. And so, the Wikipedia article evidently is referring to the first copy. Now, I don't think mine says second edition or modified or anything like that, which is maybe a little bit deceptive, but that's where the confusion comes in. Evidently, the accusations against North in Wikipedia are based on the original version of that book. So I just wanted to clarify that evidently there are two versions of that floating around, and I don't know if North has ever clarified his view on that topic or not. And if all that sounds vague, then listen to my last podcast, and you'll hear the accusations from Wikipedia, and you'll hear my counterargument to it. Now, that was a really long intro, but I did want to get that cleared up. I'm going to read a quote here from someone, and that someone is our guest today. He says, "The history you learned through approved channels was mainly propaganda. Its purpose was to hold you as a docile, obedient cog in their machine." And our guest today, Paul Rosenberg. Paul, welcome back to Bad Quaker, and it's really nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, it's great to be here. I love doing it.
I'm surprised you sat through such a long intro. That took forever.
Not a problem.
One of Paul's many projects is Crypto Hippie. Now, the last time I had Paul on the show with me, we waited to the end to talk about Crypto Hippie, and we just barely touched it a little bit. But like I told Paul ahead of time, I think today we want to talk more about that, because with all of the revelations that have come out about the NSA and Snowden and all the leaks and everything, I think it's more important than ever that people have an understanding of what the government's looking at, why are they looking at it, how are they looking at it, and what can we do about it, if anything at all. So, Paul, tell us about Crypto Hippie. What specifically is Crypto Hippie?
Crypto Hippie is a privacy network. What it does is it provides, well, many layers of encryption, and it produces anonymity. Now, encryption and anonymity are different things. With just encryption, your message can't be read, can't be understood, but who talks to who, when, and how much is all still known. With anonymity, which you get through a special type of computer network, a very complicated network, no one knows who you are. So what CryptoHippie does is we provide both. So it's essentially, it's a privacy network, and what that really means is, you know, to use it, it's a 15-minute download and setup of some software, which creates a, you know, very highly encrypted connection between us and you. And then your signal bounces between continents with all sorts of fancy stuff going on in the network in between, and pops you out somewhere else. Through one of our back doors on a separate continent, separate place from where you are. So, you know, it's a very complicated network, and it's been designed from the beginning, really, to be this. Our people, you know, I'm not the only guy. Our people are really, really good and are very good at this stuff. And, you know, we designed it that way from the beginning. Our network is 100% offshore. We have a U.S. sales office, but that's a separate company, separate ownership structure and everything. So, you know, it's a very complex anonymity network, really, and we do surfing, chat, email, even voice communications through the network are possible.
Now, just so people don't think that what we're talking about is, you know, just a new tricky way to hide, you know, selling some black market item that we all frown upon or whatever, there's a lot of different reasons that a person would want their internet activity not to be totally visible to everybody around them. Not only for the sake of not wanting advertisers to bother you constantly, but also things like, let's say there's an attorney who has a client that you'd like some private conversations with for a variety of reasons. Let's say you're working for a company that's working on a new invention of some kind or an innovation, and you want to keep that information private, and you really don't well, a person really shouldn't trust the systems of the, you know, the current internet providers and the government and all these other people, assuming that they're going to keep all your information, you know, safe and secure and everything, because they get hacked all the time. And plus, sometimes government just does really stupid things with information, like, you know, accidentally publicizing everybody's social security numbers or things like that. So, Paul, what other reasons would a person legitimately, if we can put it that way, want to hide their internet activity?
Oh, gosh, so many. You know, we have lots of investors who use our system, doctors, lawyers, accountants, you know, anybody who handles anyone else's information, for sure. But we have all sorts, but we have grannies who use our system. We have all sorts of people who just want to be left alone and to own their own life and not have give it up to someone else. You know, anonymity is really important for a lot of things, including human development. Well, it's a long explanation, but, you know, our ideas are our own, and when you put them out in public, you don't want to be ridiculed, especially when you're young and you're first forming your own ideas. It's nice. It's actually beneficial to be able to speak anonymously somewhere, so you're not terrified to put your ideas out, because if you are terrified, you never put those ideas out, and they never get fixed if they're wrong. So it's really, in so many ways, anonymity is not just, okay, it's allowed, yeah, you should have the right. No, it's important. It's necessary for healthy development.
I remember there was an old science fiction a book long time ago, and this just bouncing around my head, and I can't remember who it was or what book it was or whatever. But in this world of the future, all the walls were made out of glass of every building, of every apartment, of all houses. And so you could see through every single house, and you could see everything that everybody did. So when you woke up in the morning, somebody else could look right at you and see you. You go to the bathroom, you take a shower, whatever. Everybody could see everybody. And it was sort of I wish I could remember the book better than that. It was just, I think I read it when I was about 12 or 13 or something. But even that, the idea of it, of taking this to extreme of, you might even call it democracy, of having, you know, everything wide open to everyone else so that there's no secrecy. Taken to its extreme, it's pretty scary and grotesque. But even to right. The point it is in America today, where we know that the NSA is literally recording every phone call, capturing every email, looking at every text, whether or not they actually have a human being doing each of those things or not, they're recording it all so that they can come back and look at it anytime they want. And that's just, in my mind, that's just horrifying.
Oh, it's terrible. And you know, what they're doing increasingly nowadays is taking that data and gathering patterns from it. How does this person live? Where are they what are they likely to do tomorrow? Who do they communicate with? What type of things do they talk about? How does that change their opinions on various things? You know, these guys are not sitting still. They have psychologists that they hire and then work on these things. This is, you know, nasty, nasty stuff.
Thinking it through and where it's going to end, where government is going to take this kind of power and this kind of, these intrusions, other than the belief that I have that ultimately government is going to collapse, if I don't have that belief, my view of the future gets really, really scary.
Oh, there's a lot of reason to be scary. Now, I agree with you. Government is going to collapse. There's no real question about that. It happens every so many centuries. It happens on a very predictable sort of cycle. But, you know, gosh, we don't want to have to go through the end of the Roman Empire. Again, you know, with complete psychological workups on everyone available to the emperor at any time. This is a real nasty, ugly thing. And the truth is that they'll get away with whatever people let them get away with. they just, you know, the last 10 years have been absolute government worship. You turn on the TV at night and you see, you know, policemen essentially being held up as demigods on, gosh, I don't know how many tens or twenties of channels at once, every night, all night. It's been an era of peak legitimacy for government enforcers. Now, that is changing, and it's going to change, but, gosh, it's been a bad period from that way.
Yeah, I don't want to give my listeners the opinion that we're just going to, you know, talk doom and gloom the whole time here, but I really think things are going to turn nasty, even worse than they are, before they get better, because people, there has to be something that's going to happen to that will get people thinking, you know, all this stuff that's going on. You mentioned that it's as much as government will always take things as far as the people will tolerate. So if you look at some place like North Korea and how horrible things we imagine things to be in North Korea or whatever, our government or the government in Canada or the government in you know, different ones in Europe or whatever would be there if we put up with it, if we tolerate it. And they will take us to that point. If we allow them, it's only where people stop government. Government will always go up to that point. And the more they condition you over years, you know, that's how they get away with going as far as they do. In the case of Korea and maybe even, to a certain extent, how China has taken it. Well, there's been continuous government there longer than there has been continuous government in North Korea. So they've been doing this to these people for a longer period of time. That's why so much oppression is tolerated in certain Mid-Eastern countries and places like that, because government has been there continually doing this for so long that the people are more accustomed to it. Here in the United States, we've had little moments of freedom during our history that have almost spoiled us. But hopefully, we've got something in us still that will spark up, and that desire for liberty will come back into us as a people.
Oh, I think there's lots of signs of that going on. I am actually more optimistic than I have been in a long time. Just over the last few months, it's really, I really see a lot of good things coming together. In particular, people who are opting out of what I call the televised script. You know what I mean. You're supposed to, you know, go to school, go here, get your loans you need, get a degree, go to work at a corporation, get a 401k, send your kids to preschool, then to school, you know, the whole script that's the approved way of living nowadays. I see more and more people who are willing to just chuck it and don't care if people say they're weird. The homeschoolers who've been doing it for a long time, the Bitcoin guys, the people who are 3D printing, the people who are joining intentional communities, people who are farming, you know, in their own backyard or setting up vertical farming operations, and these are all people who are starting to step away from the central culture and doing their own thing. And to be honest, that's exactly what happened at the end of the Roman Empire, except the people who were stepping out at that point were the very, very first Christians. They didn't fight Rome. They weren't going around saying Rome has to be, you know, reshaped this way or this. They just dropped out and they said, look, you know, you're doing your thing, which we think is corrupt and barbaric, and we're going to do our thing.
It was
a big deal. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, this sounds very much like an article you wrote not long ago called "We Shall All Be Like the Hippies in This One Way." And you're talking about individual revolution. That's kind of what you're talking about there.
Absolutely. And to really have legs, to really exist over time, it has to be individuals doing this, not following somebody's pattern, not some guy who's really great at making speeches and they get all, you know, rah-rah, and follow him until something happens. This has to be each individual guy, girl, whatever, making up his or her own mind, gathering his or her own courage, and say, I'm going to live this way because it's right, and I'm dropping out and let people call me weird, and I'm going to live a better way, and it is better, and I'm going to do it. That's what changes the world.
You also mentioned that they didn't, the Roman Empire didn't collapse from the Christians attacking it. They just went and did their thing, and the Roman Empire collapsed on its own. And that kind of matches you in that same article. You quoted Buckminster Fuller, which is a Buckminster Fuller, I'm sorry, who was an amazing individual. But he said, "You never change anything by fighting the existing. To change something, build a new model and make the existing obsolete." And that is that's a glimpse of how brilliant that man was.
It really is.
That's how the death of the state happens. The death of the state will not come from revolution, from people picking up arms. It will not come from people drawing some imaginary line in the sand and saying, when the government gets this bad, we're going to start shooting people, or we're going to do this. Or that's not how it ends. Government will end when people say, when they look at product A and they look at product B and they go, you know what? I'm not buying product A anymore. Product B is better. And it's up to us to provide that product B. And that revolution you're talking about is exactly what private B is. It's the individual living their own life.
Absolutely. It always has been, and that's the only thing that works. And it will work. And if we, you know, getting through this, you know, messy time that we're in right now, once we get through it and get to, you know, a voluntary type of arrangement, or a bunch of arrangements, of which voluntarism is just one that's not, you know, beaten over the head with a club, we're golden. And, you know, there'll still be people that are jerks, and there'll still be crime and various, you know, problems. But we're golden. We move into really a golden age. At some point in the future, people will look at our time and call it the Dark Ages.
That's quite a thought, but I think that's absolutely accurate. People, at some point in time, you know, some kid reading about history will say to their dad or say to their mom, did they really believe that they needed rulers like that? It's going to be so foreign that children are going to have a hard time grasping the concept of a government.
Oh yeah, you know, we all grew up in the middle of it, so it's, you know, it's normal, and it's, anything else is weird. But when you actually, you know, write it down on paper and look at it, and try to look at it as if you just drop down from Mars or somewhere else, you know, as an outsider, it's insane. Everyone knows that the guys who are ruling them are thieves and liars, and that they do stupid things all the time, that their personal lives are worse than their own, yet they obey them. It's really kind of a mania.
It's very strange. My regular listeners have probably heard me talking about the great man theory, and talking about Herbert Spencer, and how one of the things that he did that I accredit him for is that he took this whole great man theory. Excuse me, losing my voice. He took this whole great man theory that was really gaining popularity in the 1800s, and he just smacked it down. It's like the back of his hand, in a sense, just smacked that theory right to the ground. And unfortunately, as intellectual as his argument was, and as clear as the way he did it and everything else, that the great man theory still echoes through all of education. You know, we think, well, all we got to do is, you know, get this other guy elected and he's going to fix everything, or all we need to do is, you know, we're always one election away from utopia, I guess, is one thought. But also this whole idea that there are individuals that, whether God or evolution or whatever, has brought them to us, and they are special and they are beyond everyone else. And those guys are going to save us, and those guys can tell us what law is, and those guys have the power to enforce law upon us. It's just, it's ludicrous. It's sick.
It is. But, you know, what happens sometimes is you have people that have these great ideas. Oh, we should have this, in, you know, society, you know, whatever that is, should be structured in such a way that this will happen. And these are the guys who love the great man, because they need a potentate. They need somebody to make everybody follow their, you know, their imagination. So the more guys, you know, have this great theory of how everything should be, and it ends up, you know, being approaching magic, really. if everything goes this way, everything will go well and everything will be right. Those guys love the great man. They want a big man because he's the only one who can implement their plans. If you try to convince your neighbor and his neighbor and the guy across the country to do things, that's hard. You can't convince people of magic plans. But if you get a great man, he can force them to do it.
Yeah. I should have given you a warning that I was going to take it in this direction, but you've kind of used that to dispel the idea that there's a small committee or a small group of families of humans that rule the earth, and that they're, you know, that all these big conspiracies are all just manipulations from them. And I've said that too. I've said, you know, if there really is one family or one small group of families or one, you know, tiny group of super, super brilliant people that are running all these different conspiracies, they've got to be pretty smart, a lot smarter than I can imagine, and maybe they ought to be our rulers if they really exist. But the fact is, there's just no possible way anybody can be that smart.
You know, there isn't. First of all, these guys are not that smart. If they were, they would have killed the internet in 1989 when it would have been easy. They would have killed Bitcoin a few years ago when it would have been easy. So, you know, these guys are not geniuses. There are a lot of people who want to control the world. Central bankers come to mind. A lot of politician types, you know, thug ruler types want to control as much as they can. But nobody can even see it all. I happen to have a friend who is one of the top intelligence analysts on the planet. He's written, you know, God only knows how many, you know, memos for various organizations. And I happen to see the guy every now and then at, you know, meetings of some sorts. And, you know, we became friends. And I asked him one time, I said, look, you know, there's all kinds of intelligence groups. You know, I know. I mean, it's not just national groups. There are private intelligence groups. There are groups associated with religions. There are all sorts of intel groups that do all sorts of stuff all the time. And I said, look, you know this, I know this. And, you know, is there anyone who sees the whole thing, who sees what's really going on, can see the whole picture? He says, no, Paul, there's no one. So if this guy doesn't know of anybody who can see the whole picture, it doesn't exist.
Yeah. And you would have to. You'd have to know. And now, that's not to say they're not trying to get that. That's what we were talking about a second
Correct.
Ago. They want to have enough information to rule the world. That's why they do the things that they do with you know, secrets and trying to listen to everybody's private information. They want that power, but they don't have it. There's just too much information to. And not only that, if there was a group of people that had enough information to run everything, then you would have socialism worldwide, and it would almost have a chance of working if they were smart enough to run everything. But the fact that that no one is smart enough, that's why the market works and why socialism doesn't. Because the market depends on all these separate people making separate decisions for what they view in their situation to be the best decision. And once
right,
you
exactly.
break.
You must have read the book by Leonard Reed from years ago, I, Pencil.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, no, but just in a simple pencil. There's no chance of one person knowing how to set prices for all those items. Can't be done.
Since he attempted to use iPencil as an argument against Bitcoin, I should mention Gary North again. And the absurdity of him defending the Federal Reserve dollar, the Federal Reserve note, like if it's some kind of perfect Austrian Mises money, against Bitcoin, and he tried to use iPencil as an example of that, whereas the reality is it's the opposite. Bitcoin is very much like iPencil in the sense that nobody controls it. It's
Correct.
Out there in the market. It's the design on how to make it is completely in the open. It's, you know, when if you look at the beginning of the Federal Reserve 100 years ago this month, was when they met. And, you know, in secret on an island in a retreat that was closed for the season, and, you know, secret
yep.
people met and schemed this thing together. And then you compare that to Bitcoin and you say, okay, well, We don't know exactly who did it, but the whole thing is laid out in the open. You can read the white paper. You can read the instructions on how to make your own. I mean, it's all available.
If you're a programmer, you can read the program and see exactly what it is.
Yeah, there's nothing hidden about Bitcoin.
No, it's all totally wide open and totally known.
And yet, like, just take money production through the Federal Reserve. The vast majority of people have no idea how money expansion takes place, how money creation takes place. They have no idea why inflation is happening. And right. All of that, if you look at the Bitcoin side, it's all in the open. If you look at the dollar side, it's all hidden and it's all quiet and it's all secret.
Yes. And even when you do find the information, it is just written in such a way that it's almost impossible for sense out of it. It's very, very difficult to understand.
Typically, that's sort of, for me, that's a red flag for anything. If I'm going to buy a car, or if I'm going to, I can't think of anything else right off the bat that's big money items like that. But if I'm going to invest in something, let's say, and right away, I start seeing levels of deception, or I start seeing information that's not available to me, like some kind of something's going on that I can't understand, or it's worded in a way to prevent me from understanding it. Right away for me, red flags go up saying something's not right about this. And given an opportunity, I avoid things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a book from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago published in 1990 called Modern Money Mechanics. You can find copies. I have copies. It's a PDF you can get online. And gosh, to read that thing is really rough. I mean, and I'm pretty good at reading and writing, and I had to sit down and go slowly over this 40-page, whatever it is, document. You can find the truth. It's written in there, but boy, it ain't easy. To really understand it, you really need a book like G. Edward Griffin's Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yeah, which lays it out clearly, without a lot of mystery. It tells you.
Right.
But it's
a great story.
Yeah. But in the end, you end up looking at it saying, holy cow, I can't believe that's real. That's just horrible.
The first time I actually really got it, I looked at it and went, no, that can't be true.
Yeah.
There's no way. That's too bizarre. That can't be true. But it really is.
Yeah, going back to, I believe it was Henry Ford in the 20s that said that if Americans actually understood how the Federal Reserve banking took place, there'd be a revolution in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, it's just bizarre stuff. And, that this is, these private bankers should have a monopoly on dollar creation and skim two or three times from every dollar that's created. It's bizarre.
Let's break here for a commercial, and when we get back, we'll have more with Paul Rosenberg.
The Bad Quaker staff has discovered how easy it is to get everything you need for the holidays at Amazon. Everything from the coolest decorations to hangover remedies, and everything from the latest movies and music to poop stain remover. If you follow the Amazon link at badquaker.com, Amazon will give badquaker.com a tiny portion of the purchase. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
And this is Ben Stone back with Paul Rosenberg. And Paul's website that we talked about earlier was Crypto Hippie, and that's spelled CRIPTOHIPPIE. I'll put a link in today's show notes for that. But Paul also has another website that's a really good website, and that is let me read so that there'll be a link to this in today's show notes as well, but it's Freeman's Perspective, just FreemansPerspective.com. And again, there'll be links in today's show notes for that. And at the Freeman's Perspective, there's a thing there. You can hit the button. It's usually up on the right-hand side, if I recall, about a Bitcoin report, and I'll put a link today in today's show notes to Freeman's Perspective Bitcoin Insider Report. And now this is about $30. I think it's $29. Paul, what all is in that report? What do people learn from that?
Oh, gosh. really everything you need to know for Bitcoin, what it is, where it came from, how it works, and then step by step how to use it. I mean, we have screenshots on how to set up your wallet. We actually, for anybody who buys the report, we'll send them a few cents worth of Bitcoin, and they could send it back to us, and you know that way they actually go through a transaction themselves. So it's a very detailed report. I think it's in the neighborhood of 60 pages. Julia at DGC Magazine helped me do it. So it's a very detailed report, and it's some analysis on where it's going and what type of future Bitcoin has in front of it. And then a couple interviews with, you know, early Bitcoin people and guys who really, you know, benefit for a long time.
Now, I mentioned earlier when I was rambling on in the intro that when Bitcoin peaked out over 1,200 in early part of December, you know, I was heavily tempted to sell. But I didn't. And my wife and I talked about it. We make these decisions pretty much together. And we had already thought, you know, back when Bitcoin was like $100, we thought, you know, if it gets up like around $500, we ought to sell. And we had talked about that. And then I started watching what was happening in, I believe it was early October when the Silk Road was taken down and Dread Pirate Roberts was arrested. And I'm assuming that they even got that right, but I'm not entirely positive that they got that right. But when that happened, my immediate response was very similar to what later I saw was your immediate response, which was complete confidence in the market and complete confidence in Bitcoin, and knowing that the Silk Road, being this internet dark underground market, is not the kind of a thing that the government can just snatch out of the air and throw in a cage. And in a sense, the Dread Pirate Roberts is not a person that you can go and raid his apartment and lock him away in a cage and expect the problem to be solved. The Silk Road is the road that goes on forever. And it's fluid, and it will move, and it has throughout the ages, and it's always been, and it always will be. And the Dread Pirate Roberts is not one person, and he cannot be put in a cage. We're the Dread Pirate Roberts, all of us. You can't cage us all.
Well said. And did you know that there are now at least six major new Silk Roads?
I wasn't sure the number, but I know one popped up in less than a month, again headed by the Dread Pirate Roberts.
Exactly, it sure did. And there are several more. So they took one down and they got, I don't know, at least six in its place. So, you know, these guys did not lay down and die. And the feds are used to hitting things and they lay down and die. Well, these guys didn't lay down and die. And this was a very big event, in my opinion.
Yeah, in a sense, you know, there's this moment a lot of geeks are going to relate to, but there's this moment in the original Star Wars where the wise old master is battling the ultimate evil guy, and the ultimate evil guy gets the upper hand in the battle, and the wise old good man closes up his lightsaber and says, if you strike me down, and I'll probably mess up the quote here, but he said something to the effect of, if you strike me down, I'll become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. And that's very much like the market. Whether we're talking about one aspect of the market, the one aspect of the black market or the Silk Road or whatever, you can't, every swipe that the government will take to try to bring the market into obedience and try to get control of the market, it just makes 1,000 more in every direction.
Yeah, it just spawns more. And these guys, like I say, did not lay down and die. I mean, within minutes, they were planning, saying, gee, we got to do better this time. They got in this hot time. We have to do it better next time. Okay, listen, let's get working on it right now. And it was immediate.
It's like thinking that you can, jab a bucket into the ocean and pull out a bucket of water, and that hole is going to stay right there in the ocean where you, you know,
right.
The market just is fluid and it changes. Even the Silk Road itself, the ancient Silk Road, whenever there would be some tyrant would rise up, you know, some local tyrant would rise up and try to tax the people that were coming through his area, the Silk Road would just shift and it'd go to a different place. Or the power of the market would require that that tyrant be, gotten rid of in some other way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Because all the people who are along the route, who, you know, the traders move, and all these guys are starving now. And no ruler can survive without legitimacy. Dealing, you know, with humans, ruling humans strictly by force is a losing proposition. They have to believe that it's right for them to obey you. If they don't, it's too expensive. If it's just plain robbery, if they see it as plain robbery, well, every now and then somebody's going to hit your thief in the head with a shovel. And then the thugs that you hire are going to want more money. And it's just, economically, it's a losing proposition. People have to believe that the ruler is righteous and it's right and good for them to give money to the ruler. And if you get a case like the old Silk Road where all of a sudden everyone's starving, that legitimacy evaporates pretty fast.
Yeah. And that really is what it's all about. It's this myth that, and I try to make this distinguishing, distinguish between the two different things that we're dealing with. You know, that we have the government, which is all those guys that run around and like for you to salute them, and they wear costumes and they have fancy titles and they like to be called judge and your honor and president and all these different, they just love those titles like that. That's all of that is government. But then I look at, the state, and I capitalize that as the state, as being the myth, the actual, the God that people believe in their mind gives government that authority. And I really do look at it as a religion. I think that a lot of people who pat themselves on the back and are very proudly atheist are in fact religious fanatics that believe in this God, the state.
Oh, and if you look at, you know, just the, let's pick America where we've both grown up that we know well. Look at the beginning of every sporting event. It's essentially a worship service to the state.
It really is. It's pretty disgusting.
Yeah.
From a Christian perspective, that should, you know, every legitimate minister in America should be appalled by that and should point it out.
Oh, yeah, well, that and a lot of other things, too. Yeah, absolutely.
Just for the history geeks that are listening, I expected to talk to you the last time we talked about the obsidian routes, the obsidian trade routes. And so I gathered a little bit of information. I was going to throw that out in reference to the Silk Road because the obsidian trade routes were kind of like the precursor to the ancient Silk Road. And then as, you know, as obsidian became, less essential for survival and other materials became, you know, luxury items, so to speak, like silk, although silk was, pretty handy for civilization in other ways too, but other than luxury.
Right.
But the Silk Road, sort of became the expanded version of the old obsidian trade routes.
Oh yeah. And, you know, people don't understand how far back these go. These go back to the end of the Ice Age. These are the unsung heroes of history, are the traders, specifically the long-distance traders. Every time you give people a chance, and that what I mean is you don't use violence against them for doing it, guys get up, take risks, and trade. They just do. I mean, we have maps back to 10,000 B.C., where these people had, at 7,000, they had a trading network that spanned roughly 2,000 miles. And you can tell real well with obsidian for several, you know, scientific characteristics. It makes a wonderful, you know, wonderful tool for tracking this stuff. But people get up and trade. And they're not terrified of the people on the other side of the hill. And they don't get killed every time they travel. Otherwise, there wouldn't be any trading. People on the other side are glad to see them because they're bringing things that they need. And this is what humanity does. And it's all through history. The things that really made people's lives better We're not some huffing and puffing king wanting them to grab their, you know, axes and go kill the people on the other side of the hill. It was the traders who were bringing them not only goods, but information, knowledge about other people. How do they plant their crops? How do they harvest their crops? What kind of tools do they use? What kind of language do they speak? These were the real heroes of history.
Yeah, and for the bulk of history, all these things took place without government. Government doesn't appear, you know, in the historical timeline, government doesn't appear until much later. The obsidian trade routes were very old. I think you pointed out that in time, we're closer to the pyramids than the early obsidian trade routes were to the pyramids. We're closer to the pyramids. Did I say that backwards?
No, you said it correctly. You know, the distance in time between us and the pyramids is less than the distance in time between the obsidian traders and the pyramids. These were a long way back before, you know, the school books say that there was, you know, civilization. Well, these guys were living a hell of a good life. I actually wrote about it in the newsletter about a city, now it's called Çatalhöyük. It's a city that was in Anatolia, central Turkey now, that thrived from 7400 BC to at least 6000 BC. And immense archaeological work has been done on it. There were 8,000, possibly 10,000 people that lived there at any one time. No government, no ruler, no priest, no central, you know, community buildings, no nothing. These were 8,000-10,000 people doing their own thing. And they were clean, they were artistic, they were obsidian traders, they traders in other things as well. And they lived a heck of a good life, and they were really peaceful, individualistic people. I mean, nobody knows that this existed. The archaeology is there, but you'll never, ever read about it in a textbook.
I can't remember which article it was, but I've read at some point where you quoted something that has sort of tickled my interest for a long time. You mentioned that you're especially going to see this in old museums, is this concept that back in the olden days, specifically in like ancient Greece and so forth like this, that the temple was essentially a bank, and that the people all trusted the temple, and they would bring their wealth to the temple, and the gods guarded it there. But that's really telling the story backwards, through a lying set of teeth, through the states, through the way the state wants to twist the story. In reality, you know, the Temple Mound was the place often defended the most, and it was not a place where people voluntarily deposited their money like a bank. It was the place where the tyrants took the money so that they could keep it from the people.
Absolutely. You know, all of this stuff, the stuff that you see on the walls in popular museums is written to justify rulership of the place and time. You know, everyone wants to see our time as the ultimate pinnacle and the inevitable pinnacle of civilization. Well, bull. And they write things in that way. And, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff on museum walls. The artifacts are fine. I mean, you know, they're very good at dating them. They're very good at preserving them. You know, usually the work of archaeologists is quite good. But the stuff on the walls, the interpretations of them, it's all theory. It's all whatever is trendy in the university and what's popular and gets grants. It's really sad to see. You think that, you know, the great institutions, you know, the British Museum and things like this, you kind of grow up thinking, well, geez, those must be the best people of the best people, and they must really know. They don't. I mean, you know, the archaeologists are fine, but the guys who run the museums have ridiculous things. I was in D.C. some years ago, and they still have it there, a scene from 35,000 BC in France, and they have these guys looking like almost like apes, dressed in just loincloths and skins. Well, 30,000 BC in France was in the middle of the Ice Age. the climate there was like Canada. And yeah. They got these guys standing around in a loincloth. And this is in the High and Mighty Museum. It's just, you can't believe it. It's really that stupid and that bad, but it really is.
Yeah, you see him, you see that image all the time with the, their hair is just knotted and twisted in every direction, and they all have stupid looks on their face, and they're all barefooted. And you think, if you go to any native, civilization that is pretty much untouched by modern, by modern civilization, you don't see that. You don't see them just, sitting around eating bugs, rubbing mud in their hair. They might have some strange hairstyles but then again, they might look at some of the style, the hairstyles we see today in America, and they might think that's pretty weird too.
Right, with some justification at times. Right, absolutely. You go, to places like that, these people are not, there really never were cavemen. The way they say, if there were, it was at 1 million BC, not 100,000 years ago. Those people were pretty much the same as us.
Yeah, a little hardier, from living outdoors and working for a living than say compared to the average American probably. But,
probably, yes.
Not that much different from a lot of people in third world countries that actually have to work for a living.
Oh no, absolutely not. There are very few genetic changes, at least till 30,000 years before present, and probably 100,000 years before present. They were essentially the same guys, different circumstances, different growing up, thinking different things, but we're the same guys.
And you can even, going back to the obsidian thing, if you look at some of the art from back in that time frame, and if you look at the intricacies, the amount of effort and skill that it took to make some of the weaponry with, the arrowheads and so forth. I have a little arrowhead, an obsidian arrowhead that's about as big as a fingernail, and it's made for probably either hunting mice or hunting birds, small birds. But it took so much effort to make this tiny little, essentially glass arrowhead. There's no way I could replicate it, but they did. That was common. That's what they did.
That these guys were just as good as we are, just by, we have more information than they do, thank God. But they were us. We're them.
I want to take it back to something you said earlier too. I kind of let it slip away because we were talking about so many other neat things that were coming up that I let it slip away. But back when we were talking about exchanging, what was the quote? You have to change something. You have to build a new model and make the existing one obsolete. And I was thinking about how. I mean, I hate to admit this, but sometimes when you have been living a mistake and it becomes glaringly obvious that you have been living a mistake, the best thing to do is to immediately stop that mistake. It's not to lie to yourself and continue to say, well, we have to keep doing this because this is what we were doing. And a few years ago, it was very much the trend in the liberty movement, and I put quotes around that. It was the trend to want to have government do something about the Federal Reserve, in the Fed, audit the Fed. There was all this demand for government to do something about the Federal Reserve. But really, that's kind of silly in a sense, because why would you ask the thieves to audit themselves and ask the thieves to give you a system that's different than the current thieving system that they're thieving with? Why wouldn't you instead do something in a completely different direction rather than, specifically, rather than expecting Congress to fix what's wrong with the Federal Reserve, why don't you just offer something that's competing? And that's exactly what's happening with all the different cryptocurrencies. And it just, I hate to bring it back to this, but it just blows my mind that there are people within the, again with quotes, within the liberty movement who look at cryptocurrencies and call them things like Ponzi schemes and other derogatory, inaccurate and derogatory phrases like that, it just blows my mind.
Yeah, you know, humans have a real hard time changing ideas that they've held, and God help them if they've been talking about them and writing about them. To change them requires strength of character, and not everybody has it. Everyone can have it, they just haven't developed it. So, you know, when you get these people that are attached to, with Bitcoin, the problem has been the guys who are attached to silver and gold. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with silver and gold, it's great. But Bitcoin is something different, so why can't we have both? Why can't we use both things? They both have their utility. Why not use them both? And why do you have to get into stupid, wasteful arguments, you know, spending hours and hours on, oh, this isn't bad because it doesn't meet this definition of money? Well, who cares what the definition is? I mean, usually they're even incorrect about that, but who cares? You're using it to buy and sell. Do the words on a page control the utility of the thing? No. They don't. Reality comes first. Theory comes second. Now, theory, if you have a good one, is of a lot of utility. But it's only right if it matches reality. Reality always rules.
Yeah. You know, and I hate to keep beating the poor guy up, but I read an article over at the Daily Anarchist that made the statement, and the guy that wrote the article didn't name any names, but he made the statement that essentially within the liberty movement, the people who are attacking Bitcoin the most are mostly either really old or they have never owned Bitcoin, never attempted to trade in Bitcoin, don't have a wallet, don't know anything about how it works, and yet they're more than happy to go ahead and attack it. And Seth, the guy that wrote that, I've met him, and he's a really nice guy. And I think Seth hit it right. He hit the nail right on the head. They're either old people who just, and I'm sorry, I know I have a lot of elderly listeners, and I'm old, but and getting older every day. But so often it is us, it is older people who will just, you know, knuckle down and hold on to our position and say, I'm not going to learn how to change those channels with that little, you know, controller. I want to get up and walk across the room. And, you know, you just, okay, so who are you hurting? You're just hurting you. You're not hurting anybody else but you. And that's kind of what it's like for so many people that just want to knuckle down. And in the case with Gary North, I thought you were very noble about the way that you handled Gary North in your counter to him. He used the word, well, you know, don't listen to Paul, he's a programmer. And he put that in a way, it was like an insult, like, yeah, oh, well, I can't listen to him, he's one of those dirty programmers.
You know, and the truth is that I'm really not a programmer. I work with programmers, but I'm really not. But go ahead. Sorry.
And well, then he made the insinuation that because you had a product called Crypto Hippie, and he kind of used that like hippie is a code word to discredit you. You know, oh.
Yeah, I know. I was kind of unhappy with that.
He's one of those. And then you look at a picture of Gary North, and here's this old guy with a white crew cut. And you're like, you do realize 1956 is over, right? and your best, you know, the best thing that you've got as to why Paul is wrong is because he's a programmer and he's associated with the word hippie in some way. That's a really sad argument.
You know, it really is. It's a sad situation where you get people who should know better and who will criticize themselves for being new and weird, you know, so many years ago. You know, we all develop inertia in our lives, but dear Lord, we can't let it control us.
Yeah. It really is the case. And it's not that, you know, oh, a new technology is here, we have to embrace it because it's new. No, it's really not that. I mean, I drug my feet with Bitcoin for a long time, looking at it, trying to figure out how it worked. And before I even ask anybody about it, because I'm not real fast to jump on the boat with new things, but time has, has been here. We've watched this take place. We've watched it go through a major attack against it. And maybe one of the, it could be argued right now that maybe the one of the most threatening things to Bitcoin is its sudden popularity that's driven the price up so quick. You know, who knows what the real price of Bitcoin should be. I was surprised. It seems to be, you know, as of the last few days, it seems to be having a floor of about 800 or 900. And it, with the current distribution, I was thinking more like 400 or 500 should be the floor. But then again, my opinion on that is completely useless, because the real, I mean, the real value of Bitcoin is being established moment by moment as people trade with it. And, you know, the people who are speculating, in essence, are throwing it off a bit. But in the long run.
Exactly right, yes.
In the long run with this, it could be worth a lot more than it is right now.
Oh, you know, Bitcoin is of value. The value goes up the more people actually use it. So just hold it and sit on it is really not not the greatest idea. It doesn't do anything to help Bitcoin. You know, even if you're holding it, at least, you know, take some gains by spending it now and then. Because Bitcoin's value is in being used. But there are so many ways it can be used. You know, international money transfers. It's nothing in compared to Western Union in terms of the cost of using it. Oh my God, Bitcoin kills Western Union. It kills credit cards. It kills wire transfers. It's so much better, so much faster, so much cheaper. You know, you've tried to send a bank wire. It's insulting. You have to get every tiny piece of information and go back 3 or 4 times to get it done, and then they charge you, you know, 80-90 bucks to send money, you know, that they send with electrons over the internet like we send an email. Bitcoin kills them all. So is China and India and Russia and all of South America and all of North America and all of Europe start using Bitcoin. Well, who knows what the price will go to? I don't know. It could go, it could go 10,000, 100,000 or more.
Yeah, and there are, one of the complaints with Bitcoin is that there are all these competitors to Bitcoin. But I don't see that as a bad thing. I see that as good. You know, in the early car days, I've used this comparison before, in the early days of the automobile, pretty much everybody with any mechanical inclination was jumping into their garage and pounding together their own version of an automobile. And the market produced some really weird things in the early 1900s and 1920s in the range of, you know, cars and motorcycles and things. But out of that came some really cool cars. And eventually the market gives you what it's going to give you, which is all dependent on what people want anyway. And that's kind of what's happening.
This idea that they're, you know, well, there's one currency. If there's another one, it's bad. Why? You know, there shouldn't be a monopoly on anything anywhere. Why can't there be 10 currencies? Why can't there be 20? Well, you know, at some point it's too many to keep track of, and then we fall back down to 2 or 3 or whatever it is. But there's no reason there can't be more currencies. It's, you know, not practical at a certain point, and people won't choose it. But so what if there's more currencies? Maybe something better than Bitcoin will come up someday, and then we'll all generally shift over to that.
I read something that you indicated that you knew about this. Namecoin, is that the name of it, or is it Bit? Yeah, Namecoin.
Namecoin, I know a bit about it, yeah.
That's where you can actually register domain names, and the idea is to create a system of domains that are outside of government control.
Absolutely, and it's a very cool idea. You know, really the thing that people don't get about Bitcoin often, and it is new, and it is somewhat different, and it takes a little bit of time to wrap your head around it. What Bitcoin did is it divorced secure title. It divorced title of ownership from the state. No, Bitcoin is really a ledger of title, and secure title is now in the blockchain. It's in Bitcoin, and it is more secure than anything else. And there are, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands or millions of copies of the entire blockchain all over the planet This is the most secure transmission of title that has ever existed on the planet by far. And that's really what Bitcoin is.
Going back to beating up on poor old Gary North for a second, in one of his arguments, he stated that Bitcoin, the concept of Bitcoin, destroys private property. And I read that and I physically stopped and laughed. I thought, how can you, you know, that's like walking up to a person who's in a, just a torrential downpour and saying to them, there's no such thing as water. It's just ludicrous.
It is. That is bizarre. I don't know what else to say. Eliminates private property. The mind kind of reels, you know.
It's like if he walked up and said, you know, elephant butter sandwich peanut.
Yeah. Right.
What?
And expected you to know.
Yeah.
And nod your head in agreement. Yeah.
Mumbo dog face banana patch. Wait, what?
Right. Oh, yeah, of course.
I want to sign on to your newsletter, sir.
Yeah. It's sad. It really is.
Okay, well, let's give a couple more shout-outs here for some of the stuff that you do here and make some money off of. We have Crypto Hippie, and again, there will be links in today's show notes for that. And we also have, if they follow the show notes over to the Freeman's Perspective, they can subscribe to your it's not really a newsletter. How would you describe
it? Yeah, it is a newsletter. We have the free articles on the site, and every month we produce a subscription newsletter, which, you know, just is a gas to do because, you know, like I talked earlier about Çatalhöyük, this city, the first human city after the Ice Age, which was an anarchy, and a peaceful anarchy, and a very, very successful one. It lasted longer than any Egyptian dynasty or Sumerian dynasty or the Greeks or the Romans. And so, you know, one issue I devoted to that and I remember 10, 12 pages of this with photos and everything else. We do the coolest things in the newsletter, you know, because I have time. If for the articles on the site, you know, I think and hope they're good, but, you know, they're limited to 600, maybe 1,000 words. In the newsletter, we really get to do the cool stuff.
I've said before, there's a couple people that are kind of famous on the internet, and I've said before that of the different ones that I think of, you, maybe Bill Buepert, and a couple other people are the closest to the way I think on the widest variety of things. I think if you and I sat down and just went into a contest to try to find things that we disagree on, it would be, I think we'd have a hard time. We might get into obscure theological situations where we could disagree, you know, if we really tried. but I think overall, if I had a criticism of your work or of you or whatever, I would say that when I go to Freeman's Perspective and I read an article, I get to the end of it and I think, man, if that was just a little bit bigger, it's the old thing in vaudeville where, you know, the rule is you leave them wanting more. And I get that from every one of your articles. I really appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. You're more than welcome.
Well, thanks for coming on the show with me, and open invitation. Anytime you want to come back on, just drop me a note, and we'll get
you
in here. Folks, I want to give a quick reminder that now and then I'm going to be over on the Freedom Fiends Live radio show. If you're not getting enough podcasts, be sure and tune in to the Freedom Fiends. They're live every Saturday and Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. They're on the Genesis Communication Network. They're carried on something like 16 or 18 radio stations nationwide. You can listen to them at gcnlive.com or go over to freedomfiends.com, and there's all the links there. I'm filling in now and then while Nima Vedati is on leave taking care of his newborn baby, and there's a lot of other great guests over there as well. So, you know, if you're not doing anything else, Saturdays and Sundays, 1 p.m. Eastern time, get over to Freedom Fiends and give a listen to see what Michael and the crew over there are saying. And folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.